Okay, it's taken a bit longer than we would have liked, but the course load of my school and work has demanded a bit of a slower pace for the podcast. We've been a bit more diligent on the blog, thehistoryofeurope.blogspot.com, but this too has begun to slow down. However, on the last podcast, we did wrap up the Stone Age by completing the second Neolithic podcast. So since we began back on April 26th of 2012, we've covered an astonishing 2.8 million years. Fortunately, though, the podcasts will get a bit more specific and will slow down a bit. It's kind of like the game Civilization, if you've ever played it. You know what I mean. It starts out that every turn is like 25 years until it whittles down to a turn per year. So we still have hundreds and hundreds of podcasts to go, which is both exciting and daunting at the same time. However, before we move out of the Stone Age and into the Copper and Bronze Ages, I think it is important to discuss one final Stone Age topic. That sound means it's time once again for the History of Europe podcast. I'm Chris Linehan, and you are listening to Episode 6, The Rise of the Indo-Europeans. The term Indo-European today is often associated with language. This is because it is believed that the Indo-European languages spoken throughout Europe, Southwest Asia, and then wherever Europeans colonized was brought to Europe by Proto-Indo-European peoples. Along with the language came culture and religion. In this podcast, we hope to display a couple of the leading theories about who the Indo-Europeans were and where they came from. This wanting to find the origin of the Indo-Europeans has produced a bevy of theories and hypotheses. Each theory seems to have its own Urheimat, a compound German word meaning original homeland. While many Urheimats have been proposed, there are four that seem to get the most bang for the buck in academic circles. That said, even when scholarly people agree on an Urheimat, it doesn't follow that they agree on everything else. While people much smarter than I have poo-pooed other theories, I'm going to include a couple of them because I'm not sure if any Urheimat truly existed. I think that things didn't quite evolve so neatly, and Europe was, over the millennia, a melting pot that saw cultures clash and come together rather frequently in prehistoric times. That said, I think that a fifth Urheimat ought to be included with the other big four. So before we dive into a whole bunch of theories, let's put forth the big four and my added fifth to start things off. The top four Urheimats are as follows. One could have been a Pontic Caspian origin sometime in the Chalcolithic, probably between 5000 BC and 4000 BC. Two, it could have been an Anatolian origin in the late Mesolithic, early Neolithic period of roughly 7000 BC to 5000 BC. Three, it could have come from Baltic origins and stretched out slowly from 6000 to 3000 BC. Fourth, it could have had a Balkan origin that began roughly expanding into much of Europe around 5000 BC. If you have listened to the Neolithic or even Mesolithic podcast, you could see how any of these four could be a good Urheimat because so much of the culture in Europe was influenced by these regions. The Kukuteni Tripilians, with their massive cities, came out of the Pontic Caspian region. Anatolia long had an influence over southeastern Europe, where in Romania, some of the earliest modern human remains were found. Anatolia also held sway over the Balkans. The Balkans have had the earliest site of Neolithic farming in Europe. The Baltic region, however, was dominated by hunter-gatherers for a long, long time, deep into the Neolithic period. So these guys would have had the potential to spread their culture through vast swaths of Europe. With culture comes the language and religion. Their tendency to move could have easily brought about major shifts. But to these four theories, I would like to add a relatively new theory, the Paleolithic continuity theory. This theory states, without getting too much into the detail and spoiling my section on that, the Indo-Europeans developed naturally out of the existing cultures in Europe during the Paleolithic, Mesolithic, and Neolithic from the cultures that were already present in Europe. While I think this may be too simplistic for a whole Indo-European language tree to develop, the constant migration and trade between Stone Age people could have afforded enough cultural interaction to create a relatively homogeneous society that would have seen recognizable traits spanning from Portugal to Russia and England to Bulgaria. All that is to say is that A, we don't know where the Urheimat is, and B, we don't even know if there was an Urheimat at all. But if we're placing bets on history, we would be wisest to choose the Indo-European origins as coming from one of the five places: the Pontic Caspian Steppe, so modern-day Ukraine, Russia, and Kazakhstan, Anatolia, modern-day Turkey, the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, or the Balkan regions, which comprise Albania, Bosnia, Bulgaria, Croatia, Greece, Kosovo, Macedonia, Montenegro, Romania, Serbia, and Slovenia, or from wherever they were in the continuation theory. Admittedly, the Paleolithic continuity theory would have the longest odds. So, let's dive into some of the less reputable hypotheses of where Indo-Europeans emerged from before we get into the more reputable ones. There is something called the Arminian hypothesis, and it is the theory that said that the Indo-Europeans came out of the highlands of Armenia sometime in the 4th millennia BC. This theory is based on the Glottic theories, of which there are many. But in basic terms, the idea is that the glottal stops, common in many Germanic languages and Armenian, were noticeable in the time frame we just mentioned on the highlands of Armenia. From there, this language peculiarity spread throughout Europe, and along with it, a significant amount of culture and religion. This theory has a whole bunch of forms, ranging from the idea that the Armenians spread European culture in Europe to something called the Greco-Aryan theory that states that the Greek language, Armenian language, and Indo-Iranian languages of today are closely related because the Armenians of the 4000 BCs decided to migrate all over the place, pushing into southern Europe, into the west, and then down into Mesopotamia and India in the east. Glottalic theories were initially popular in the 1950s, but its popularity has waned significantly over the years. Some of the current supporters of the Armenian hypothesis today use it as a cog in a wheel of an even grander theory, the Nostratic language theory. This theory tries to place together all the languages dating even further back than the rise of the Indo-Europeans. It lumps basically all of our language families together as the Nostratic having been spoken in Paleolithic times. Johanna Nichols, a linguistic professor at UC Berkeley, has pushed the Urhamet of Europe even further east using this theory. She has come up with something called the Sogdiana hypothesis. Sogdiana is located in modern-day Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. Sogdian language has morphed into the modern Yagnobi language that is still spoken in part of Tajikistan. Like some of the Armenian hypothesis variants, Indo-European origins come from an Aryan or Indo-Aryan origin in this theory. Thus, as the culture and language shifted west, the old Europeans were replaced by or changed into the Indo-Europeans. For this theory to have any real validity, though, the migration would have had to have started much earlier than the 4th millennium BC, which isn't necessarily the end to this theory, considering one of the most popular theories puts the rise of the Indo-Europeans deep into the 5th millennium BC. However, this theory hasn't gained a whole lot of traction among most Indo-European studies. Since we're headed that way, we might as well go all the way and hit upon the Out of India theory, or OIT for short. It's also called the India Urhamet theory, but I'm generally getting tired of the word Urhamet. Though, we're going to probably have to use it a couple more times. The OIT might very well be the granddaddy of the bunch. Enlightenment thinkers like Immanuel Kant, Carl Wilhelm Friedrich Schlegel, and my personal favorite, Voltaire, firmly held that the original language of the Europeans was, or something close to it, Sanskrit. Voltaire said basically that all knowledge came to man from the Ganges River. Immanuel Kant thought that all of science came from the roof of the world, i.e. the Himalayas. But, in spite of this glowing endorsement, even some of Voltaire's contemporaries realized that the similarities between Sanskrit and early European languages was due to the two having a similar forebear rather than one preceding the other. The OIT would eventually die a relatively slow death until in the late 1800s, when the philologist Robert Gordon Latham suggested that a language family likely originated where it is most diverse, rather than where it is least diverse. According to Latham's logic, the origins of the Indo-European language tree would be from Central Eastern Europe, where there are a number of subgroups, and not India, because there is almost no linguistic diversity. In 1999, however, the OIT received a bit of a revival. A theory was put forth in a peer-reviewed journal without the peer review part. The editor of this journal, J.P. Mallory, who I'm indebted to greatly for a lot of my research into this topic and much of the prehistoric work I've done so far, explained his decision to include the paper that rekindled the OIT in terms of an East versus West thinking. Basically, Mallory understood that no Western academic would accept the paper and review it positively enough to be included into his paper. But Mallory asked people to look at it and consider whether it was thought-provoking enough to get a response. Some of the reviewers said that it could elicit a response, and thus the paper was published, and this is the idea of why it was included in a peer-reviewed journal without the peer review. First in Italy, India, was the pre-Harappan people. These guys were just learning how to farm and make some basic pottery. Some of these guys decided to move westward around 6000 BC. Those that stayed put in India became the early Harappan, and then the mature Harappan, and then the Harappan proper. Those that left, though, spread west into Bactria, which is in modern-day Afghanistan. These OIT Bactrians continued to march into the west, where they ended up on the shores of the Caspian Sea. These Caspian guys would discover the horse and then send it back to the Urhama, India, before expanding into Anatolia and Southeast Europe. From the foothold in the Balkans, the India Indo-Europeans would end up conquering all of Europe. Besides this idea of coming out of a Hindu nationalist desire to be the Urhama, the theory has a whole bunch of other flaws, though. Many of the other theories rest on the use of horses to spread the Indo-European culture, so that's nothing new in the OIT theory. But the fact that this theory would have had the horses sent back to the homeland really smacks of a convenient ad hoc. So we'll lay the OIT and its revival aside and move on to another, more reputable theory. Okay, so let's go back to where we started with the Big Four, or five if you consider the Paleolithic continuity theory like I do. Let's start with the Balkans as the Urhamid. The Balkans seem like a prime case for a homeland because so much of the first things in Europe occurred here. Farming, pottery, and then later on philosophy, political theory, and feta cultivation all came from the Balkans, and we are forever indebted to the invention of the gyro, the world's first sandwich. The Greeks, though, are en route to becoming another first, getting kicked out of the European Union. If that happens, there will be plenty more time for the podcast writing and podcast listening, because the world economy will tank, and we'll all have a lot more time on our hands. So let's hope the Greeks buck their knack for being first. But because of this knack, we're going to have to, and some early archaeological evidence, we're going to have to consider the Balkan Urhamid now. Linguistically, the ancient Romans noted that a number of languages spoken on the Balkan peninsulas that were precursors to a number of modern Indo-European languages. Cone Greek would be by an indirect path would evolve into modern Greek. The Balkan languages around the time of the Romans may have developed into Albanian, Armenian, and others in the region. Because of this, some postulate a Balkan Urhamid. However, this is the smallest of the Big Four in academic circles. For those who cling to an Anatolian Urhamid, they dig a bit deeper into history than those who like the Balkan one. For the Anatolian homeland to work, the cultural diffusion had to take place from around 7000 BC to 5000 BC, rather than later the 5000 BC date given to the Balkan one. The evidence for an Anatolian one is also stronger than for the Balkan one. The Anatolian Urhamid is bolstered by the wave of succession that brought farming up from Anatolia into most of Europe. In this hypothesis, the culture would have spread peacefully rather than through war, which we'll talk about in a second. This peaceful diffusion was put forth best by Colin Renfrew in 1987. For what it's worth, in a mathematical statistical study used by Russell D. Gray and Quinton D. Atkinson that I found difficult to read and comprehend, also backed up the Anatolian theory as well. This paper used Bayesian inference to show that the timetable backed up the Anatolian hypothesis. However, even Colin Renfrew has changed his mind a bit because of criticism he received after he put forth the theory. The criticism of the Anatolian Urhamid comes from the known usage of words in the Proto-Indo-European vocabulary that predate the cultural diffusion from Anatolia into Europe. The Proto-Indo-European word for armpit, which is ak, ak apostrophe s, served as a root word for the English word axle. If the Anatolian Urhamid were entirely correct, then the words that were derived from axle would have to come after the axle had been received from Anatolia. However, the cultural diffusion wouldn't have reached Upper Europe by 7500 BC, and wheeled vehicles are previously found in cultures that thrived in Ukraine long before Anatolian culture could have reached into the Ukraine. In response, Renfrew has adjusted his theory and said that a pre-Proto-Indo-European language has its roots in Anatolia, but the actual Proto-Indo-European language has its roots firmly in the Balkan. Thus, the Ur-Hamit of the Proto-Indo-European language is the Balkans, while the Ur-Hamit of the pre-Proto-Indo-European languages is in Anatolia. To tie it nicely up together, though, he said that the Balkan Ur-Hamit was synonymous with the old European culture of Marija Gimbutas. It is at this point that we should discuss the most widely accepted academic theory on the origins of the Indo-Europeans. This is the Kurgan hypothesis put forth by the Lithuanian-American archaeologist Marija Gimbutas. We've mentioned her here on the podcast before, but now we'll get into devote a bit more time to her properly and discuss her influential theory and a few variations of it. The Kurgan hypothesis corresponds to the Pontic Caspian Ur-Hamit. But before we can talk about the Indo-Europeans coming into Europe from the Pontic steppe, we have to talk about who was in Europe before the invasion began. And this invasion, unlike Renfrew's vision of a peaceful advance of farming techniques, was spread by the onslaught of war. In this sense, I guess that the Kurgan hypothesis is a pre-Attila the Hun, who in turn was a proto-Genghis Khan. Maybe. I don't know. But I'm using the words pre and proto a whole lot in this nonsense. All right, so the old Europe culture was the pre-Indo-European Neolithic culture of Europe that thrived in relative homogeneous way throughout the continent. The book entitled The Goddesses and Gods of Old Europe, 6500 to 3500 BC, lays out the idea of Old Europe and the Kurgan hypothesis quite succinctly. This is one of Marija Gimbutas' best-known works. The Kurgans came into Europe during the Bronze Age, and thus, the culture of Old Europe is entirely Neolithic. Anytime we refer to pre-Bronze Age Europe, Gimbutas would hold that this is Old Europe and its culture, not later Kurgan culture in the Bronze Age world. Old Europe lasts roughly from about 7000 BC until about 1700 BC and corresponds with Greece transforming from the Mesolithic at the front end and Northwest transitioning from the Neolithic into the Bronze Age at the back end. The Chalcolithic period or Copper Age is lumped into both categories depending on your researcher. We'll do our next podcast on the Chalcolithic to give it some love so copper doesn't feel left out of the mix. But for now, we're going to focus on the end of the Neolithic. While this date range is pretty big and covers various parts of Europe, Old Europe societies had a number of consistent qualities regardless of date or region. According to Gimbutas, reading of the archaeological evidence, the communities of Old Europe were similar or smaller and more egalitarian than the city-state or chief-dominated communities of the Bronze Age Europe. Whew. I say according to Gimbutas' reading because some of the theories are disputed. The size of the community, though, is one that is regarded as accurate by most thinkers. Neolithic Europeans tended to live in smaller communities than their Bronze Age or later counterparts. However, whether they were egalitarian or not is something that is disputable. Other undisputed attributes of the Old Europe settlements surround the eating habits of Neolithic Europeans. Old Europe subsisted on small-scale farming. They domesticated a few types of plants, which varied by region. They kept small stocks of domesticated animals, and they supplemented their diet with time-tested traditions of hunting and gathering. In addition to these food-producing and or gathering techniques, Old Europe cultures made pottery without the use of the potter's wheel. Beyond these cultural similarities, though, Marija Gimbutas noticed a number of things that made her think that there were a number of traits that all these pre-Indo-European peoples shared. However, this next set of traits we're about to list have been disputed by various archaeologists because she used folklore to create a new field of study called archaeomythology. Since myths are disputable and often open to interpretation by their very nature of being myths, the inclusion of myths in constructing a history was bound to create some controversy. From this new field, though, she gathered that the pre-Indo-European cultures were egalitarian, matriarchal, matrilineal, peaceful, and practiced a religion that venerated mother goddesses above their male counterparts. Conversely, Bronze Age Europe, the Europe of Indo-Europeans, was stratified, patriarchal, patrilineal, warlike, and practice a religion with male-dominated deities. Also courting controversy, Gimbutas suggested that the pre-Indo-European European cultures shared a similar language, citing the similarities of symbols on pottery shards found throughout Europe and the symbols marking on the graves of Neolithic Europeans. However, this acceptance of a similar pre-Indo-European language was not the construct of Gimbutas, but of earlier archaeologists. So, since we know who the Kurgans were now replaced, we should discuss the Kurgan hypothesis that Gimbutas laid out in the Goddesses and Gods of Old Europe and earlier works. First of all, the word Kurgan is a Turkic word for the tumulus, which is a fancy word for a burial mound. The Kurgans then, as would be expected, liked to bury their dead, or at least the important ones who died, in burial mounds. Since the Kurgan showed preferential treatment to some and not to others, the egalitarian nature of old Europe is instantly lost with the arrival of the Kurgans. The Kurgan culture is an overarching term for various cultures that originated on the Pontic steppe, including the many cultures that came from the Dnieper and Volga regions in Russia, Belarus, and the Ukraine. Specifically, the Yamna culture, who we'll cover in the Chalcolithic and Bronze Age podcast, seem to have been the Urheimate for this Gimbutas' Kurgan hypothesis. These nomadic herdsmen would eventually displace the old Europe cultures in both Eastern and Western Europe through slow conquest. The use of domesticated horses by the Sredni Stog culture helped to spread the warlike Indo-European mantra throughout Europe and Central Asia. Gimbutas thought that the spread of the Kurgan culture could have been done by a small number of people on horses and chariots when they fought the peaceful and non-horse-riding old Europeans. However, this would have left a small number of Kurgan's elites in charge of a peaceful pre-Indo-Europeans, but recent genetic studies have painted a different story. The genetic evidence suggests a complete changeover when the Indo-Europeans arrived, wherever they arrived from. The spread of the Kurgan culture as the arrival of the Indo-Europeans is the most widely accepted variation of the homeland of the Indo-Europeans. However, there is a whole lot of criticism for Gimbutas. In addition to reading her works, I've read a number of authors who have tried to discredit Gimbutas' theory entirely or in piecemeal attempts. The objections to Gimbutas often, though, come in a far less scholarly format than what Gimbutas has put forth to tell her theory. However, in reading these criticisms and her original work, I do notice a bit of a jump towards the matriarchal, peaceful notion that she loves so much. However, to denounce her thought as socialist propaganda with a feminist bent, as some do, is a bit overblown. Maybe she is overextending her hand when she calls the pre-Indo-Europeans matriarchal. The evidence is negotiable. The prevalence of the Venus figures that she cites as a matriarchal society could only suggest an importance of the female deity, but not its preeminence over the unimportant male ones, as Gimbutas would like to say. So, in reference to this and other evidence, some scholars that hold to Gimbutas' theory of origin divide away from her when she starts talking about the matriarchal old Europeans. So, now on to the fifth of the most plausible scenarios as to where the Indo-Europeans came from, the Paleolithic continuity theory. This basic theory states that the Paleolithic peoples of Europe gradually evolved into the Indo-Europeans and either assimilated or adopted new cultures as they came into their fold. The deep dates of this theory provide ample problems for it to be a truly viable genesis theory. However, there are more nuanced versions of this theory that are much more plausible. The one that I like best comes from Marek Zavlibi and is called the Neolithic Creolization Hypothesis. This theory states that the Indo-European earliest homeland was in fact Europe itself. The Neolithic and Mesolithic communities of the north were semi-nomadic hunter-gatherer groups, and the Neolithic ones distinguished themselves by making pottery. So being semi-nomadic meant that you would have to move around a lot to catch your food. As these groups moved along, they would intermarry with more sedentary food-producing cultures like the linear pottery culture. In this theory, the Kurgan hypothesis isn't completely ruled out because the Kurgan influx would have acculturated and helped to shape the Proto-Indo-European language, but the Urhamit would have firmly been Northern Europe, albeit a supplemented one, a supplemented homeland by invasions from both Central Europe and Central Asia. Other variations of this theory tweak the data so as to link this melting pot idea with an Anatolian Urhamit. This, I think, however, stretches credulity, as these northern cultures would have had a more difficult time traveling down south through warlike cultures in the Kurgan or Kukuteni-Tripilian regions of Ukraine. Some of the best evidence for this Neolithic creolization hypothesis come from the previously mentioned linear pottery culture, the Langyo culture, and the funnel beaker culture we've mentioned on other podcasts. But later cultures like the globular, amphora, and quartered ware cultures also provide backup for this theory. Basically, all of these cultures decorated pottery and figurines with similar markings that may have been a proto-alphabet. If this is a correct reading of the scribbles and swirls on pottery and grave goods, then a proto-alphabet would have demanded a proto-language. And thus, this is the where the Indo-European language and culture came from. So, now having said all of this, what exactly have we learned? Let's go ahead and sum it up in 10 quick points. 1. The Indo-Europeans came from somewhere. 2. That somewhere could have been modern Turkey. 3. That somewhere could have been modern Armenia. 4. That somewhere could have been Central Asia. 5. That somewhere could have been India. 6. That somewhere could have been Persia. 7. That somewhere could have been the Balkans. 8. That somewhere could have been all of Europe itself. 9. The Indo-Europeans could have spread their culture and language peacefully. Or 10. The Indo-Europeans could have spread their culture and language violently. See what endless possibility history has afforded us? What exciting times we are living in. Okay, so regardless of where the Indo-Europeans came from, when the Indo-Europeans came into Europe or developed in Europe, the culture drastically changes. Gimbutas is not incorrect in noticing a marked difference from the Neolithic cultures and the Chalcolithic and Bronze Age cultures. As we move on and get closer and closer into historical times, you'll see some of the differences of the Neolithic cultures and the Bronze Age cultures. So, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up for this week. Join me next time on the History of Europe podcast as we move out of the Stone Age and into the Copper Age. Remember to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, check out the blog at thehistoryofeuropepodcast.blogspot.com, and subscribe to us on iTunes or Podomatic. I'm Chris Linehan, and thanks for listening, and I'll see you again next time.